Came across this paper. It's fast. I want to spend on this. Maybe we'll see how it goes. Maybe 2 days, maybe 3 days. Not more than 3 days, I hope. It's called Mitzrayim, Midrash, and Myth. Mitzrayim, Midrash, and Myth. I think a lot of people here are going to really, really love this book. Are going to go buy it. I know for sure that Mayevsky is going to buy this book. I have no doubt about it.
What's the name of it?
Mitzrayim, Midrash, and Myth. I should get a commission. Buy. He writes here on the cover, Yisrael Cohn. He has one, I don't know who he is, I have no idea who he is. He has a Haskama from Rabbi Bruidowitz, from one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Or Sameach.
Did he read it?
Yeah, he did read it. He wrote for him a beautiful, beautiful, eloquent. You have to read the Haskama. Bruidowitz.
Yeah, he's very famous. He's from
Or Sameach. In addition to that,
he was a lawyer.
He was a Rav. He was a Rav Kihilas. He is a Rav. Rav Kihilas Or Magid Shir Yeshivas Or Sameach. Rabbi Emeritus. Where is the Rabbi Emeritus from? Woodside Synagogue of Havastara, Georgia. Silver Spring, Maryland. Correct. Correct.
He went to which college? A very famous college. He was like a lawyer and a big time chacham. He was the one that wrote the OU magazine. That very interesting issue about one who go off the derech.
Rabbanim?
Yeah.
Shulchan or Rabbanim? So what did you say? Who was there?
Rabbanim who were involved with scandals.
Oh, scandals.
That's a good
talk. Favorite talk. Okay, Rahman, let's lot. Okay, the Sefer...
Myth is Minagoda.
Let me explain. What?
Myth.
Myth means... No, nonsense. Myth means narishkeit. A myth... Myth in English... Myth is an English word. It's an English word which it means nonsense. Nonsense. What?
People believe it's true.
Alright, you should read the Haskama. You buy the book, you should read the Haskama. It's a beautiful Haskama. Such eloquence. He writes with such eloquence, and it's so clear that he read the whole book, and he right away addresses one of the main issues that if you even are allowed to write such a book. Because this book, what he has done over here in this book is he has analyzed Egyptian, what's the word? It's called Egyptianology?
Egyptology.
Egyptology. Egyptology. Two T's. Egyptology. You pronounce the T, goes both ways. Okay. Egyptology. Is that right? Correct? He has dug up, and he writes here in the Haggadah, a lot of the information he has here in this book was only first available to us very recently. Right. Some information is only the last 30 years. Right. Some information 50 years, some goes back 100, and most of it does not go back more than 200 years. So there's almost no way, in many instances, that the early Achronim could have known about what he's writing, what he's saying, and even the Rishonim. Even you look at you take out a Chumash Mikros Gedolos, and you look at the Rishonim and they're writing things to say Pshat in the past. That was universal. You have to have a Muni, you have to have a Masorah. There's a tradition of what the Pesukim can mean, different ideas. But, and he's very, very careful. He's very, very careful. And in fact, I'll explain to you how careful he is in one moment. He has studied thoroughly. I only read very, very little. I'm just fascinated just from the one chapter that I read. I want to present to you in a few minutes, and we'll do a lot more next week. He has thoroughly studied the culture of Egypt in the time of Yitzias Mitzrayim, the best that he could, because a lot of what happened during Yitzias Mitzrayim has disappeared. You wonder why.
Well, Abba Yehuda wrote down that the 210-year period of Golan
wiped off.
They
wiped off.
Wiped out
right. They just like the Christians have completely tampered and whitewashed and just whatever the history with the history, because they know there are a lot of things that are not in their favor. So to make it easy for them, they just I'm giving an example that just like the secular history which deals with the origins of Christianity has been tampered with. That's a given according to all opinions. No one really knows exactly the truth of what happened during the period of time of how Christianity came to be from secular sources, because they themselves have completely tampered with history. So too, the Egyptians were so humiliated So what has happened to them with Yitzias Mitzrayim, they erase from the records that we were ever there to begin with. Okay, look at modern times. They tell us that we have no rights to Yerushalayim. We never existed. Like, the lies are outrageous. Okay, the outrageous lies. So this is something nothing new. This goes back to the time of Yitzias Mitzrayim. They had very precise records of every little thing that happened in their time, all their religion, what went on. And they just, when they were so humiliated with the fact that we were able to escape, and we took with us the Rechush Gadol, the Bizas Mitzrayim, what happened to Paro, what happened to all, they drowned in the Yam, it never happened. They erased it from history. So there's a lot that we do not know from secular sources. I'm dealing now with secular sources, not from Jewish sources. We have a Masorah. We have our Masorah. So the best thing you can do is to reconstruct what happened from other sources. The Egyptian culture before the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Egyptian culture after Yetzias Mitzrayim, other countries, look at their history, and you put together a big picture of all the different pieces of information. You do research, you're professionally trained in doing these things, you can put together a piece of what exactly life was like in Egypt for a non-Jew, for an Egyptian. What will I find? And the information that he's presenting here is stuff that is relatively was not known, certainly not to the Hamoina, not to the masses, not to the common man. The common man did not even access to know this information until recent times. What do I mean by recent? Some stuff is in 30 years, even less. What? 1812.
Until Napoleon went into Egypt, there's no such thing as Egyptology.
Wow.
No one knew anything.
Okay.
Now, the library in Alexandria was destroyed, so there was no Zeichen.
Okay.
You had the Dark Ages, so no one was interested in it until they...
Okay, excellent. So here's what he does, in a nutshell. We're going to do a lot of this in Belina the next week. We're going to do more deep, but let's just do a few little things out. Basically, he's doing he starts with the Rambam. Everyone knows the Rambam. The Rambam, the Machlokes, the Rambam and the Ramban. He's really using this Rambam as the basic premise, the whole Yesoid for his book, the whole book. The Rambam asked the question, what is this that we have, korbanos, sacrifices? We have an animal, we sacrifice an animal to Hashem. Well, what is this all about? What is this today? You sacrifice an animal to Hashem, you get credit, you get how does this work? So the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim says something that is shocking, utterly shocking, which everyone has been stunned, but the Rambam is the Rambam. Rambam is Kodesh Kedoshim. The Jews, really, Rambam says, there's not Kurbanis, there's no purpose in Kurbanis. Doesn't do anything. An animal sacrifice, what are you trying to accomplish? But you have to understand, the Jewish people, they lived in Egypt for 210 years.
The culture
was a pagan culture. Every day, people were offering sacrifices to the gods. All different types of gods. There are hundreds, if not thousands of gods. It was steeped in their blood, being in this environment for 210 years, this is how you worship a god. The way you worship a god is by taking an animal and sacrificing the animal to a god, offering incense, doing this, doing that. So when the Jewish people left Egypt, and Hashem said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, lo yihye lecha elokim acherim al panai, you may not worship any other gods, the only god that you worship is me, they felt, how do we worship Hashem?
But then Noach,
that's what the Ramban's question is. That's the Ramban's question. How do we worship Hashem? How do we worship Hashem? We have a need. It's in our blood. The only way you can worship a god is through offering sacrifices. So Hashem gave them a permissible outlet, a way to express the need to serve Hashem by giving them korbanos.
So why do we yearn to do that again?
So this is what the Rambam. So the Rambam basically is saying. The Rambam is basically saying is that korbanos is just a response to the secular pagan culture of Egypt. That's what he says. In Egypt, this is what they did. It's a shocking thing. Wait, one second. It's a shocking thing. In Egypt, I'm not saying this. I would say this. I would be shut down. Shut down in a second. Anyone would say this. This is what the Rambam says. It was a second. Egypt is a place. Egypt is a place of Avodah Zarah. And this is what the Jews were accustomed to. This is what they did in Egypt. Now they've been told there's only the Ribbono Shel Olam, they need an outlet, a way to serve Hashem, and that's what korbanos are all about.
Also to offer, satisfy our desire for bloodlust.
But the main point we may make now.
We adapted their worship form?
No. Let's not go that far. That's dangerous what you're saying. That's going too far. But let's just say, the point is, it is a reaction to what they were accustomed to in Mitzrayim. This is the Rambam. The Ramban goes wild. Yeah. How could you say, Mr. Mueller says, it's Noach. Noach offered a korban. He was told to take into the teva 7 kosher groups. 2 only for the non-kosher. It's only a male and a female. For the kosher, it was 7. Why? Because he was going to offer the 7 as korbanos. So you see from the time, and the numerous midrashim, that Adam Harishon, he was offered a korban a par, which had only 1 keren. Okay, only 1 keren. This memory chazal that tell us that Adam offered korbanos and Yaakov the Ovois, the Mizbeach. How can you say this? What's going on? So this is a topic of discussion. The truth is, Elu v'Elu divrei Elokim chayim. That's the common answer, is that there are 2 different elements. There are inyanim. Korban is extremely holy, sacred. It's a mystical thing. Adam HaRishayim, Noach, the Avos. There is something to korbanos. But you have to understand, the common man in Egypt, who came out of Egypt after 210 years in Egypt, being in Egypt, and having sunk to the 49th level of Tumah, had you been there 1 more second, they would have sunk to a level where they would not be worthy of redemption, was not holding on the Madrega of Noach, was not holding on the Madrega of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. They were not holding on that madrega. They were not ready to understand the deeper meaning of korbanos. For them, it didn't make any sense. For them, you tell them what it's noyach. It doesn't draw them. They related more to the pagan culture of Egypt, and as a response to the pagan culture of Egypt, they needed an outlet. It just happened to work out to coincide very conveniently. Is that there's something really true about korbanos, which we today in our day and age certainly don't understand. I think it's been acknowledged, right? The biggest gedolim is that today, Bizman Hazeh, we have absolutely no hasaga whatsoever. What is the purpose of bringing a carbon? We're not on the level to understand this. What you want to say, because I should really give up my life, and in exchange for me, you're going to give an animal? Even that's too hard for the average man to understand.
Well, in Goshen, did they do carbon?
No, I don't know what they. We don't know. That's not the point. That's not the question here. We Bizman Hazeh, we really have no clue what the meaning of korbanos is. But we do have emunah that there is a very holy element or a very holy thing of bringing a korban.
But there are theories like the one you just said.
But even the one that I just said is just words. A person has sinned. Hashem, I should give up my life. I'm chayev misa. So instead of giving up my life as a surrogate, I'm going to give an animal. Those are very nice words. Does think about it. Is that really fair? Why should I take the life of the animal? It's very nice. I don't know. Maybe you understand it. I have a hard time with it. We are ma'minim, b'nei ma'minim. This is a davar that is very, very, a whole Torah is all about korbanos. Kachem, I mean, what was I? We live with emunah. That's the way the world is. We live with emunah. Adam brought korbanos, Noach brought korbanos, the others brought korbanos. This Hamikdash sent us around korbanos. When Mashiach will come, we will be uplifted to understand the deeper meaning of what korbanos is all about. Until then, we have emunah. The people that came out of Mitzrayim related to us. They also did not have any concept of what this hechara, this holy union of korbanos, is all about. So when you start telling them to bring korbanos, midin, Adam, and Noach, and the others, they wouldn't know. They wouldn't really understand what's going on. However, when you tell them that you do to Hashem something similar, the way that the Egyptians, they worshipped korbanos to these avodah zarah, that they relate to. So elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. The Ramban is correct. There's something extremely holy. The Rambam is correct. The Jews who left Egypt were not holding on this madrega. They would not understand. Therefore, they had to be introduced in a backwards way as a rejection of the Egypt culture to do it in a permissible way. This Yesodi takes with this principle that what is being presented to the Jewish people as they leave Mitzrayim and everything that is happening in the end of Bereishis and in the beginning of Shemos, every single thing that you're going to read about, the 10 Makos, Moshe Rabbeinu being cast into the Nile, Eishes Potiphar, the Pyro, the interpretation of Pyro's dreams, everything, not only that, no stone is uncovered. Every single thing can be seen. You can see a parallel, a very direct parallel in the culture, what you call Egyptology. You can use that as a starting point to understand a whole new perspective. That's the whole book. Now, he did something very strange in this book. He wrote this whole book, and then he sent to the editor, and the editor wrote him a letter. Wrote him a letter, and he actually prints the letter, very long letter, with a whole letter, and he prints the letter in the first chapter. When do you ever have a situation where you have improvised the book, and they print you in the chapter, in the book itself, the letter that was sent to you by the editor criticizing your book, we're not going to publish it. And then the rejection letter, and then the response why you should publish. Not exactly like I'm saying is, but that's pretty much what it is. Because the editor says, what kind of crazy book is this? You're writing a book? You're writing a book and you're telling me in the book that everything in the Torah is all, the whole Yados is all just a reaction to a pagan nation, Egypt? You have a nation of Shugoyim, pagans, who do the craziest, most corrupt things, and the whole Torah now is just an adaption, a kosher adaptation. Like you have a movie, so the movie has some non-kosher scenes, so you have to go clean up those non-kosher scenes. So the Torah became the kosher version of something which originated by a bunch of Shugoyim and Ovdei Avodah Zarah. What kind of crazy book is this? That's what the editor wrote to him in response to this, because that's what the whole book is going to do. And we go through many very, very geschmackig examples. Very, very, very. So he says, you're missing my whole point. That's what it says. Chas v'sholom, chas v'sholom. Very important hagdama. Chas v'sholom, chas v'sholom. That's not what I'm doing here. Maminim b'nei maminim. But you have to understand that the Torah is so rich. It's so deep. There are so many dimensions. It's like the Ramban and the Rambam. Korbanos. Adam HaRishon offer Korbanos. Noach offer Korbanos. The Avos offer Korbanos. Who cares about Egypt? There was never an Egypt. There would be Korbanos. The Pshuta Shel Mikra, when you learn the Chumash and you learn the Rishonim, the Rashi and the Unkelis and the Targumim and all the Rishonim, of course, this is the Iker. But we have to understand into Ayin Panim LaTorah. There's another dimension in Torah, which is very, very fascinating, and it allows us to appreciate the Torah as a response, as a parallel to what was taking place in Egypt at the time. So it's true, you're walking on a very, very tight line, a very tight line, yeah?
Why is that? Why is it controversial? Because secular knowledge is...
It's not just secular knowledge. There's no secular knowledge here. This is not a matter of secular knowledge.
What? Egyptology and the
fact... That's a reality. That's not secular knowledge. That's not science. Reality. That's not even science. That's facts. Open up the newspaper. Is Trump the president? Is Trump not the president?
Facts are... When it comes to facts, are to be ignored.
I'm sorry. You want to tell me science? Okay, I hear the argument, even though it doesn't make any sense.
If that were not the case, it wouldn't be controversial.
It's not controversial.
It's controversial because facts are to be ignored if they don't come from a kosher source.
So you're focusing on something which really is a problem. You're focusing on something else, and that is there's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch and the Gemara. You're not allowed to learn about Avodah Zarah. You're not allowed to even say the name of Avodah Zarah. You're not allowed to mention the name of an Avodah Zarah. Before he wrote this book, he says he spoke about this issue because writing this whole book required him to thoroughly understand the nature of the multiple forms of idolatry, idols that existed in Egypt, and to take those ideas and then analyze Chumash and the Mefarshim against. Are you allowed to learn? Are you allowed to do what he did, to go to the degree and go to the museums and go and study Avodah Zarah and write about it and analyze it? It says in the Torah, you're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do this. It says in Shulchan Aruch, you're not allowed to do this. So this is a very big problem. Not so simple. And that's really the main point of his haskama. Why you got this haskama is that when you're doing it lit to Elis, If you just stop doing it for fun, you want to learn about idols, you're curious. I'm curious to know how do the nations of the world bow down? What do they do? It is categorically forbidden. But when you're doing it to use as a tool to further appreciate your relationship to Hashem, to further appreciate the Torah, HaKadoshah, then it's permitted. And not only is it permitted, it's noble. It's the right thing to do. And not everyone understands that. That's why it's controversial. It's not controversial because these are the facts. This is not science. You have to understand. You have to go and spend. This is you're too cynical. This is a halachic issue. Right. It's a halachic issue where you're delving much too much on idolatry. You're studying the nature of idols and analyzing psukim k'neged avodah zarah. And that, he said, he spoke to all the rabbanim and they all gave him the green light. They gave him the green light. And he says, you're doing this is a tool to elevate your yirah shamayim, your appreciation of the Torah, and therefore it is perfectly permitted. And people have to understand that, and that's exactly what Rav Breidowitz, how do you pronounce his name? Rabbi Breidowitz? Rabbi Breidowitz. Breidowitz wrote in his Hakdama.
So what's an example of something that was found?
Even Rabbi Breidowitz, he writes here, he's very hesitant. He writes here, while there are, of course, serious halachic issues connected with the teaching of how do you say this word? Idolatrous beliefs, rituals and customs, and it is my understanding that Rabbi Cohn is seeking a definitive psak from a recognized authority. I do want to note that Rav Moshe Feinstein permitted the teaching of ancient idolatrous legends, specifically Greek myths, when they were taught in a way that demonstrates their foolishness and falsity. Indeed, he considered an expose of their foolishness to be of positive benefit. And he gives you the chapter and verse of the Igros Moshe. Okay, so he writes over here, Rav Moshe was pro, and then he writes, I believe Rabbi Cohen's book falls within these guidelines, especially in light of the elucidation it provides to the biblical text. Moreover, the dangers of Sifrei Minus attracting new followers simply do not allow to ancient, archaic religions that are extinct. Alright, he goes on to explain over here, well, in short, while I do not feel competent to offer a definitive psak that you're allowed to write this book, I am willing to declare that to the extent halakhically permitted, this is a useful, helpful study that can assist the reader in obtaining a deeper understanding of many passages in the Torah and Chazal. So even though I don't want to give you a psak, I'm giving you a psak.
It's mutter.
What?
Before he started working on the book.
Whatever. He writes here, half the letter over here is he's struggling. You gave me a book. The book is a knockout. It's unbelievable what it says here. I want to do Raton. I want to do that. I'll get it. Everything in the book is a knockout. But you should know, I realize, Rob. Okay, I'll give you one simple example. It says in the pasuk that Yosef was 30 years old. He Yosef ben Shloshim Shana when he went out, al Mitzrayim. So what does it mean to 30 years old? Very nice. It says, you know, we have in Yadus a Yovel 50 years. 50 years. In Egypt, in this time period, they had a 30-year Yovel. The number, the 30 period of time was sacred. Every 30 years, Paro, it says, Yoim Huledesh Shel Paro. All the Mepharshim struggle. What does it mean that the Sar Hamashkim and the Sar Ho'ofim? They were at the crossroads. Will they live or die? When was Paro going to make his decision on his party? When was the party? The Yoim who led the Shal Paro. The only time in Tanakh we have a mention of a birthday party. And that's the whole big debate. Is it a good thing to celebrate a birthday? Is it not a good thing? By Goyim, by Jews, back and forth, the whole Torah about that. Who says it was his birthday party? Yoim who led this. So you look in Rashi and Mepharshim. Some say it was an anniversary of his coronation, the day when he became Paro. Others say it was indeed his birthday party. What?
Huledis, Rabbi Alfred says, Yom Huledis, his wife gave birth to
Paro. The successor. It was the day, some say it was the day when he fathered, when his son, the Bukhar was born, who would replace him, would take over, would inherit his throne. Everyone is struggling. What is this Yom Huledes? Vos meint the Yom Huledes? Well, when you uncover all the ancient documents of Egyptology, you will discover that there was a practice in Egypt in this very, very time that after Pharaoh was a pharaoh for 30 years, they made this magnificent celebration. The whole country, it was that was how they did it. Every 30 years, as a pyro lift, it becomes pyro. If you survive for 30 years, then you are renewed. It was like a renewal. Your contract is renewed from the gods. And they made this massive celebration where they joined together pyro. There are two parts of Egypt. There's the upper Egypt, the lower Egypt. And pyro would do all these strange, bizarre things. The country would come, and a lot of things had to do with boats. They would then send out into the water little ships, little boats. That was part of the Avodah Zarah. So when Yosef now, Paro decided after he successfully interpreted the dreams, and he decided to make Yosef into the Mishnah Lamelech, when it says that he was 30 years old, it doesn't just mean simply, this is like the balance, that he was taka 30 years old. Paro interpreted this to mean that you've already been in this world for 30 years, now this is like a sign of renewal for you.
For Yosef.
For Yosef. And he did for Yosef exactly what they do for Paro when Paro reaches 30 years into his office, into his tenure. When a Paro was 30 years into the tenure, he's like, Yovel Yishmadror, it's a Gansa Maisa. I don't can even describe it because I don't even know what these words mean. Can't pronounce these words. Whatever that. They did a whole show, the Avodah Zarah, and especially keep in mind the boats. The boats were very, very important. Part of the ceremony, which involved, went on for weeks, and involved the whole country, was they would go to it and they would send off a little boat to go from one place to the next place, little boats. Moshe Rabbeinu, as I'm telling you, Moshe Rabbeinu, how did Moshe Rabbeinu come onto the scene? They put him in a teva, in a boat. And the Bas Paro went out to Lirchetz al Hayar, and who is traveling in a little boat down the Yar? Moshe Rabbeinu. When someone, a boat, travels suddenly along the Yar, and the person's inside, this is not a simple thing in Egypt. And according to their theology. So Moshe Rabbeinu was like a god almost. A child is going down the Nile. You say this in Yeshiva Katana, they're going to say, throw you out. What do you think? What are you talking? What are you saying over here? But when you know, I guess, maybe you're right. But when you know what the culture, what went on in those times, everything has new meaning. Paro, this is a reality. Every 30 years, Paro was renewed. It was an Avodah Zarah, which happened. Yosef, you're 30 years old. You're 30 years old. That means from the time that you were born until now, that was your first tenure in the world, serving a function of who knows what. And now you're being renewed here in Egypt to be my Mishnah Lamelech. Moshe goes out, was sent into the Nile on a boat. This was something very significant for their culture. Okay, well, I'll tell you one other quick thing before we go. Parab, Eishes Potiphar. Eishes Potiphar, why did she wait for this particular day? So in Egypt, this was the day of fertility. Chazal said, he goes along with Chazal, said that she saw Piruach HaKodesh, that she would have a child from Moshe Rabbeinu. She did not know, from Yosef. She did not know, would it be from her, or would it be from her daughter, or maybe she thought it was from her. So she went out, it was a day when no one was around. Everyone would, it was a holiday. What was the holiday? So Rashi says, everyone went out to the Nile. The Nile rose, and everyone went out either to see it, they went out to worship it. So there is a holiday. There are three seasons. We have four seasons. In Egypt, there are three seasons. And the beginning of the season starts at the end of the summer. And 2 months later is when there is this big festival when everyone goes out to the Nile, which happens always to coincide with our Rosh Hashanah. Our Rosh Hashanah, it always coincides. This festival in ancient Egypt, the calculations are, because it was also like a solar setting. These all things that we know now. The year began 2 months later is when the Nile reaches its peak, and they all went out to the Nile, and the whole theme of this festival was fertility. Fertility, having children. So she, Eishes Potiphar, which was very much in tune with the culture of this land, if I had a dream that I'm going to have a child with this man, if not now, then when? Now is the time to take advantage of this. That's why it was Bidafka. She went to Yosef at this particular time. Okay, there's a lot more. Believe me, I will discuss some of these things.
An adopted daughter.
What?
An adopted
daughter. Osnatz. Yeah. Osnatz, correct. Kol ha-gadol yosem kili yoldoim.
Good afternoon.